Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
You know, in life, no matter how much you are down, if you are willing to give your best and fight, you know, you can always have a fighting chance to come back.
We had to rise from the ashes.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 25th of June, these are our main stories. The head of UNICEF says 9 million children in Sudan don't get enough to eat, and almost none are in school as the conflict there continues. Less than a week before parliamentary elections, President Macron of France has warned that the policies of the far right and the hard left could lead to civil war. Three major American record companies are suing two AI firms, accusing them of infringing artists' copyright to create music. Also in this podcast,
the nuns were trying to buy a monastery in a nearby town, which the church apparently vetoed.
Now they've locked themselves into their Spanish convent, saying they're being persecuted by the Catholic Church and no longer recognise the authority of the Pope. We begin in Sudan, where there's been a stark warning from the United Nations, saying the country now has the largest displacement of children anywhere. Malnutrition, starvation and millions out of school makes it one of the worst places in the world for children, the agency says. The country has been torn apart by more than a year of brutal civil war with catastrophic humanitarian consequences. Here's the UNICEF chief, Catherine Russell.
A famine doesn't happen overnight. Once it hits, it's very hard to turn it around. We need to act now. It's just going to get worse. You can always eventually make progress on something, right? So nothing is completely impossible. But for individual babies, for children who are starving now, who are hungry, who are severely malnourished, yeah, it will be too late for that.
Catherine Russell was speaking to the BBC's Barbara Platt-Usher, who told me more about how the situation has become so dire.
Well, Alex, the war has just really been very punishing. The pillars of the food economy have collapsed. That was a big thing. And farming in particular, because of looting and insecurity and lack of transport and markets and so on. You had grain shipments from Ukraine that have stopped. And you would have humanitarian aid, but both warring parties have been restricting the flow of aid, and that's been quite crucial to the increase in hunger and the hunger crisis, to the degree that some are asking whether this is actually part of battlefield tactics. And that is a question that I did put to Catherine Russell.
Do you think the two sides are using starvation as a weapon of war?
You know, it's hard for me to say that. I don't know what their intentions are. I can only talk about the result. It is 100% a man-made famine, a man-made problem here, for sure. I mean, there's no question about that. The challenge for us is not that we don't have the food or that we don't have the access to it, is that we can't get it to the people who need it.
Catherine Russell, that's clearly heartfelt. We can hear her describing the difficulties that UNICEF is facing. What is needed to turn things around, to stop Sudan and its people from facing further disaster?
Almost immediately, it's access and volume. And this is what aid organizations have been shouting from the rooftops, so to speak. They say get in large amounts of life-saving aid quickly and consistently. But as I mentioned, there have been restrictions. You have the army blocking delivery of aid across conflict lines into RSF-held territory. You have the RSF being blamed for a lot of the plunder. And it's now been besieging a city of nearly 2 million, Al-Fashir, for more than a month. So that's the most immediate method. But long term, you know, the only solution is an end to the fighting. So essentially and crucially, the economy can be restored and then everything else can follow.
Is there really, though, any hope of that actually happening? All the recent efforts to restart peace talks have failed and the recent appeal from the UN was ignored.
Yeah, there isn't any real hope of that actually happening soon. The UN did demand that the fighting around al-Fashir end, and it hasn't. This new American envoy has been trying to restart peace negotiations. That hasn't worked. The Sudan's army chief, the de facto head of government, basically said there aren't going to be negotiations or a ceasefire until the rebellion, as he called it, referring to the RSF fighters, was defeated. You know, what the UN Secretary General has said is that peace efforts fail because both parties have made a bet that they could win militarily. But it should also be said that they fail because the two parties are strengthened in those positions by regional powers who have backed one or the other. So it is a very complex situation, and there isn't really any clear sign that it is going to get better anytime soon.
Barbara, it is a story which I keep hearing colleagues saying it should be at the top of the news agenda more, but so often it isn't. So often it slips down.
Yeah, I did ask Catherine Russell about that. She said that there's a lot competing for attention. She mentioned other crises in the world. Others have said it's not just Sudan's forgotten war. It's just deprioritized them and the international powers. Although they do make an effort, they don't persistently engage in a way that lifts it above a regional crisis, which is how it seems they're treating it, when it could become much more than that, given the strategic place that Sudan occupies in East Africa.
Barbara Plett-Usher. Next to France, President Emmanuel Macron has warned that the election policies of his far-right and hard-left opponents could lead to civil war. Speaking ahead of the first round of voting in France's parliamentary election this weekend, he said that both sides divide people on the basis of identity.
Si on va au bout de votre raisonnement, le pays explose ou c'est la guerre civile. Et c'est ça mon grand.
If we follow this logic to the end, the country will erupt, or it will turn to civil war. And that's why I deeply disagree with both extremes, and I disagree with those who follow them.
Mr. Macron called the vote 2 weeks ago after the far-right anti-immigrant National Rally Party came first in the European elections. They're currently ahead in the opinion polls, with a new alliance of left-wing parties second and Mr. Macron's centrist group in third. Nicolas Cancur is the National Rally candidate for Normandy. What did he make of President Macron's comments?
The president should not say such a thing. In addition, it's not a possible threat, he mentioned. He owes the French people to bear his own part of responsibility and what led to this. He's been in command, the commander-in-chief, for the last 7 years, so he's definitely to blame. We've landed today.
Rebecca Kesby spoke to Catherine Norris-Trent, senior correspondent for the French television network France 24. She began by asking her, how is President Macron's recent remark being read in France?
It's provoked some astonishment at the strength of the words he's used. So he's hitting the headlines. Presumably that's what he hoped to do in going on this podcast, trying to win back electors who maybe have drifted away from him since his first election in 2017 and then in 2022. He was on this podcast, which is hosted by an entrepreneur, and it's a very chatty tone. So he had a very wide-ranging discussion for 1 hour and 45 minutes, during which he made these comments about the risk of the country exploding and the country turning to civil war as part of that. So it will be seen perhaps as divisive, perhaps as him trying to scare off people from voting to alternatives to him. And whether it appeals to his base, well, you know, remains to be seen.
I mean, we know that Mr. Macron already has a fight on his hands on the right, doesn't he? He pretty much said the same after those elections, the European elections. This does seem as though he's opening up a new political fight on the left, though, as well. And is it going to urge people to the centre or actually undermine his own party in the centre?
Well, it depends how much credibility Macron himself retains. He's a very divisive and unpopular figure in France. He's not well loved by the French population, including by previous supporters. He's much criticised. So on the left and on the right, you've got very strong voices and hard-line views coming forward to oppose him. So Macron is trying to position himself as in the centre of that, the voice of reason, reasonable politics to cut through some of the hard left and hard right, so that if you want safe politics, a safe pair of hands, then you've got to vote for my party.
And briefly, is there any kind of concern that security itself could be in danger after this election?
Well, there are a lot of fears in France right now about it. People are bracing themselves for demonstrations if the far right gets into power, perhaps after the first round of voting and after the second round of voting too. We've had large street demonstrations for the past few weekends and on some evenings too in France. You know, protesting is a big thing about politics, and that often degenerates into clashes with riot police. So there are real fears that this is a turning point and could potentially degenerate into disorder, albeit if not civil war.
Catherine Norris-Trent, a senior correspondent for the French television network France 24. 3 days of mourning have begun in the southern Russian Republic of Dagestan after 20 people were killed in targeted attacks on Sunday night. Most of the victims were police officers. Churches, synagogues and a police post were attacked. 5 gunmen were killed. The Kremlin has dismissed the possibility of another wave of Islamist violence in the northern Caucasus. Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg reports.
In the Russian Republic of Dagestan, this was a coordinated attack on 2 cities. In Derbent and Makhachkala, gunmen targeted churches, synagogues and a police checkpoint. Among the dead was a Russian Orthodox priest. Gun battles with security forces raged long into the night. By morning, the anti-terrorist operation was declared over. The local authorities declared 3 days of mourning for the victims. The head of Dagestan, Sergei Melikov, said the insurgents had aimed to destroy inter-ethnic unity. He stated he knew who was behind the attack, but didn't say who. The suspicion is that there is a link to radical Islam. In recent years, the Islamic State group has claimed responsibility for a string of attacks in Dagestan. And yet the Russian authorities appear reluctant to talk openly about the Islamist threat. Since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, the official narrative here is that the greatest threat to Russia's security is from Ukraine and the West, which explains why a Russian MP went on state TV to suggest that it was Kiev and NATO that orchestrated the Dagestan attacks. Not everyone here is convinced. One Russian senator wrote on social media that if his country blamed every terrorist attack on scheming by Ukraine and NATO, the pink mist, as he put it, would bring Russia bigger problems.
Steve Rosenberg. Authorities in the European Union are accusing the tech giant Apple of breaking new laws designed to rein in such companies. The European Commission said Apple's App Store unfairly squeezes out rival marketplaces. The firm could face a potential fine of up to 10% of its global revenue. But Apple says it's confident it's complying with the law. The Commission, though, has serious doubts, according to spokesperson Thomas Reynier.
Under the Digital Markets Act, app gatekeepers, basically developers, should be able to steer consumers to alternative offers, cheaper options outside of the App Store. And following our investigation, we now have doubts and we believe that Apple is in breach of the DMA when it comes to these steering rules.
The technology journalist Chris Stockel-Walker explains what happens next in the row between Apple and the EU.
They basically have until March next year to further investigate. The allegation, obviously, is that Apple is in breach of the Digital Markets Act, which is a bit of legislation passed in November 2022, came into force in May 2023. And one of the really interesting things is it's one of a suite of laws that the EU has put in place and is using to try and tame big tech. It's not shy about doing so. And so this is not the first time that the European Union has started to act against these companies, but obviously with Apple being so big, 400 billion or so in revenue, and 10% of that could be at stake here with a fine. 40 odd billion could be at stake here if they were found to be in breach of this. And also it's worth noting that the European Commission opened a separate issue today alongside this, investigating additional fees for apps that are very, very popular, of individual downloads that are charged to the providers. But I think there's more at stake here than just this one fight. This is a case of big tech kind of being brought to heel for the first time in maybe 20 years, and they're not really very keen on it. So I think that actually, yes, we will see a large number of fights going on here as the European Commission tries to bring these people back into force, and actually they don't want to have that happen at all.
Chris Stockel-Walker. The Poor Clares of Belorado, a group of Catholic nuns in Spain, are famous for the chocolates they make. They sell them online and in two shops in the towns near to their convent. But they've now locked themselves into their convent, saying they're being persecuted by the Catholic Church and no longer recognise the authority of the Pope. Their archbishop says they have been excommunicated and must leave the convent. I asked our Europe regional editor, Nikki Cardwell, how does a group of nuns fall out with the Pope?
Sounds rather strange, doesn't it? Apparently this originates from a property deal. The nuns were trying to buy a monastery in a nearby town, which the church apparently vetoed. They wanted to know where the money was coming from. There was a benefactor and who that benefactor was. And it appears to have led to a big dispute. The church got the deal cancelled, which resulted in the nuns losing rather a lot of money. And it's escalated from there to the point where they were no longer responding and have made this statement on Instagram saying they no longer recognise the Pope and they are doing their own thing. They want to follow an ultra-conservative former priest, again, a man who's been excommunicated, and they say they don't recognise any Pope since the 1950s.
Wow, this doesn't sound like your stereotypical group of nuns.
No, it doesn't. It's quite a lot of contradictions. They are talking about this old-fashioned view. They want to go back to a much more conservative view of the church. Yet at the same time, they are very modern. They're on Instagram. They're on social media. There was a new intake of nuns brought in 1999 to bring the average age down. They were the ones that came up with the idea of making chocolates and selling them so that they could bring in money to help themselves subsist and to improve the convent in which they live in. So it's actually, they are very modern from that perspective. And then you have the other side of the coin, which seems to be that they're leaning towards this ultra-conservative side, which the church doesn't recognise. Now, whether or not they've been influenced by this man who is this religious leader, who knows? But either way, this is a real problem for the church.
Can this be resolved, or are the nuns literally going to be thrown out onto the street?
Well, that's what it's looking like at the moment. The local archbishop has done a press conference this afternoon and he's been very, very strong, saying you've got to get out or we're going to do it legally. Now, it would seem to me that that kind of confrontation is exactly what the church doesn't want. It doesn't look good for them. These are older women there and having to be physically removed. They're also very social media savvy. So it is possible that this would all play out live on social media. I doubt the church want that. They must find a compromise.
In a couple of seconds, is nun chocolate delicious?
I wish I knew.
Our Europe regional editor, Nikki Cardwell. Still to come, why this sound?
The common greengrass, it sounds like a sewing machine. And this is the species that is disappearing with climate change.
Is fast becoming a thing of the past. This is the Global News Podcast. The Lebanese authorities have organised a tour of Beirut International Airport for journalists and diplomats in an effort to disprove claims that Hezbollah is storing weapons there. It's also threatened to sue the British newspaper, which made the allegation. Karine Torby reports.
The tour was intended to show to the world that Beirut Airport is safe. The Lebanese authorities say that claims are part of a psychological warfare against Lebanon, while some in the country have expressed fears that this could be used by Israel as a justification for a possible targeting of the airport. Israel has struck Beirut Airport before. The last time was during Israel-Hezbollah war in 2006, when Israeli strikes on the airport halted flights in and out of the country.
Karine Torby in Lebanon. And the row comes amid fears that growing clashes between Israel and Lebanon's Hezbollah could lead to all-out war. At least 21,000 children are estimated to be missing in Gaza, according to Save the Children. The charity quotes a UNICEF report from February on children being separated as families were displaced. More are thought to have been affected since Israel's assault on Rafah. Mike Thompson reports.
Save the Children says around 17,000 children are thought to have become separated from their families during mass displacements caused by the fighting. Many lost touch with their parents when around 1 million civilians fled the Israeli military's ongoing offensive in Rafah City. The aid agency estimates that a further 4,000 children are thought to be either missing under rubble, detained, or buried in unmarked graves. Its child protection teams have called for urgent action to protect separated and unaccompanied children in Gaza.
Mike Thompson. In Colombia, the historic peace agreement signed between the government and the rebel group the FARC in 2016 led to hopes for an end to a conflict which killed hundreds of thousands of people. But since then, hundreds of disaffected FARC rebels have resumed fighting, accusing the government of betraying the terms of the deal. On Monday, peace talks between the Colombian government and the rebel group led by Iván Márquez began in Venezuela. I asked America's regional editor, Leonardo Rocha, how important is this meeting?
It's very important because it's an opportunity for Colombia to go back on the track of peace negotiations, of peace. The agreement with the FARC, which was by far the biggest rebel group in Colombia, had been fighting since the 1960s. That was very important, was reported all across the world. And one of those who negotiated, probably the chief negotiator for the FARC, was Iván Márquez. Well, he's now the leader of a rebel group that defected. He went back into the jungle in 2019 to start this new fight. They've agreed to come to the table again with a different group. Most of the FARC members have given up on the fight and given up the weapons, but you still have hundreds of fighters, about 1,600 to be precise, with this group, the Segunda Marquetalia, and you have other criminal groups, other rebel groups and criminal groups in Colombia, and the rebel groups are increasingly involved in crime, involved in drug trafficking and other activities.
Yeah, tell me more about Iván Márquez. Why did his group and others abandon the peace process?
Well, what happened in 2016, there was this deal, but a few years later, there was a new government coming into power, right-wing President Iván Duque, who was very critical of the agreement. And some of the FARC members were being arrested and being facing the prospect of being deported to the United States. And they thought that the government had betrayed the terms of the deal. Some, not only Iván Márquez, but others have defected and say, well, either we go, we leave now, we're going to be arrested, according to them, unfairly. And that's why they resumed the fighting.
The president has been trying to engage with rebel groups pretty much since he came to power 2 years ago. How's that going?
Well, it's not going very well. President Gustavo Petro, he's a former rebel himself, a former Marxist rebel, and he launched, when he took power in 2022, the Total Peace Initiative. But so far, he has managed to engage with three groups. He invited everyone to get involved in peace talks. He managed to get the biggest rebel group, the ELN, in talks, another faction from the FARC, to get involved in peace talks, and now the Segunda Marquetalia. I think it's very important for him to get this going and to have a prospect of peace within his government.
Leonardo Rocha. Three major US music labels have sued two artificial intelligence firms alleging mass copyright infringement. They're the latest legal battles between the music industry and tech companies offering AI tools. Jason Lee reports.
The viral song BBL Drizzy, made using AI generative software by the American producer Metro Boomin, is just one of many examples mentioned in one of the lawsuits. It's a diss track targeting the Canadian rapper Drake. In two separate cases, Universal, Sony and Warner, jointly with the Recording Industry Association of America, has filed lawsuits against Udio, the AI software maker, and Suno, an AI music platform. The association's CEO, Mitch Glazier, said the firms were copying artists' work and exploiting them for their own profit.
Jae-sung Lee. For half the world, It's summer, and indeed this week in the UK, with the days at their longest, this week should herald the beginning of one of the loudest moments of the year. There'll be an explosion of natural sounds, led by the chirrup of crickets and grasshoppers. However, that sound is changing dramatically and rapidly. Our correspondent David Sillitoe has been in Dorset in southwest England to meet a composer who's beginning a tour of works inspired by the changing sound of summer.
Where are we going?
We're going down to Fiddleford Mill, which is on the River Stour.
You are?
I'm Karen Wimhurst. I'm a composer and clarinetist.
And in the case you've got?
I have a speaker and my B-flat clarinet.
When you're offered a chance to wander down to a riverbank in Dorset, in the southwest of England, and listen to a duet between a clarinet and a cricket, you say yes.
So here
we go.
Well,
this looks like a meadow.
Yeah, beautiful meadow.
And it's not just any cricket. It's a bogbush cricket.
Is it this spot in lockdown where I came down and every blade of grass was covered with grasshoppers? I've never seen anything like it here, or again, actually. Lockdown was, you know, on the one hand, a very bleak time, but on the other hand, it gave nature space. I mean, these crickets have been singing for 300 million years, and they've got this kind of rhythm and repetition and structure, which we all associate with music.
And the point to all of this, ever since that one cacophony in lockdown, the field has been silent.
The latest report which has come out said there's been a 75% decline across the UK in the last 20 years of insect life.
And it's with that thought in mind we've come here, Brittick Moor, and I'm with Peter Sutton.
What do you do?
I've been a national recorder for Orthoptera and allied species for over 20 years now.
You're Mr. Grasshopper, aren't you?
You could say that.
The place he's brought me, armed with his grasshopper net, this little corner of rural Bedfordshire, just to the north of London. Well, it's a bit boggy. There's rusty corrugated metal lying around, and there's a distinct whiff.
Yeah, normally this would be alive with insects, but things are very late this year.
Thankfully, Peter brought along some of his favourite grasshopper song, because there was a point to our little ramble. Things are changing fast in the grasshopper world.
This is the song of the Brazil's bush cricket.
That's a completely new sound to me. This is new to this area, then?
Well, as of over a decade ago.
And which, in insect terms, is
rapid.
We're talking 300 million years, and then suddenly they've...
Yeah. The rate of colonisation of these species no one would have predicted.
And Dungeness in Kent,
the tree cricket,
is starting to sound Mediterranean.
So if you're down in Dungeness, this is what you would hear in the summer.
Really?
Absolutely, yeah. Amazing sound.
However, the overall story is one of disappearance. Even the common grasshopper.
The common green grasshopper sounds like a sewing machine. And this is the species that is disappearing with climate change.
This is what summer used to sound like.
Yeah.
Is the amount of singing you're hearing each year going up or down?
Generally speaking, it's most definitely going down.
The changing sound of summer is getting quieter.
It is. It is getting quieter, yeah.
A thought which takes us back to Karen's field. And what we noticed when the music stopped.
It's June. I can hear the reeds. Traffic.
Yep.
It's not a buzz of anything, is there?
No, it's gutting, isn't it?
That report by David Sillitoe in southwest England. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.